Okay, international travelers know this reality. It is often hard to find safe drinking water. Even in rising nations like China, hotel staff warn you not to drink what's in the tap.
In countless other places, the affluent drink bottled water while everybody else lives with the risks of the local supply. This reality persists even though governments and charities spend millions of dollars to provide safe water.
David Kestenbaum of our Planet Money team traveled to Kenya to find out why it's so hard.
This is a beautiful spot in western Kenya. The farms around are lush. There's a lovely spring. A boy comes by to fill up a container.
How are you?
I'm doing fine.
What are you doing?
Getting drinking water, he says. The spring water looks clean, but of course, there are some things you can't see. I'm here with Evan Greenlow, who works for a group called Innovations for Poverty Action. He bends over and fills up a cup.
Looks good, right?
Yeah, it looks really clean.
Would you like some?
I don't know.
It's not a good idea.
Drinking a cup of water can kill you, or at least make you really sick. Alex Mwaki works for Care Kenya on water issues. I asked him what might be in that nice, clear cup of water. He sighed.
It might contain fecal contamination, pathogens like those ones causing cholera, the Vibrio cholerae.
Also typhoid, dysentery, parasites, typhoid. Worms.
Worms, intestinal worms.
All particularly dangerous for children. Not surprisingly, getting clean water to the world has been a top priority for years. And for a while, it looked like this was just an engineering problem. If there's no clean water in a village, dig a good well. Or if there's a spring, there are ways to protect springs. Do that. This turned out not to be enough, though. When Alex Mwaki tested water in people's homes, often that water was still contaminated. Maybe the container the family used to fetch the water wasn't clean, or the container was clean but the cup people used to scoop the water out wasn't, or the water got stored in a big clay pot at the house and kids stuck their hands in it. So many ways for things to go wrong.
My reaction, I would say, was, we still need to do more. We have not done much.
So one of the next ideas was chlorine. If families brought the water back to their homes and then added just a tiny bit of chlorine, that should protect the water. That way, if bacteria get in somehow, zoop, the chlorine would kill it. Simple. And today, there are lots of efforts to get chlorine to people in areas with unsafe water. In Kenya, you can buy little bottles or tablets in the stores for pennies. Problem solved?
If only it were that easy.
This is Evan Greenlow again with IPA. He says surveys show that only a small percentage of people in Kenya buy the chlorine, even though it's cheap.
Getting it to happen in every household every time proved to be an extraordinarily difficult task.
So here is the latest iteration, what Evan's group thinks is the best approach to date for helping people in rural areas get safe water. A chlorine dispenser by the spring or well. Basically an upside-down bottle of chlorine with a handle that releases a measured amount.
So it says, Tibu Maji Yakunwa, which is treat your drinking water.
A tiny bit of chlorine is enough for 20 liters of water.
It's very simple. A lot of its success is in its simplicity.
Success is a relative term. We spent an hour at the spring, and everyone who came by did use the dispenser. But it turns out, if you test the water in people's homes and villages where the dispensers have been installed, only 40% test positive for chlorine. Just 40%. Even when there's chlorine in an easy-to-use dispenser by the spring at no cost, not everyone uses it. Some people don't like the taste. Some people are afraid of it.
Sometimes you're in a rush or you're thinking about something else and you just don't do it.
But it's right there.
I know.
Which might be frustrating if it weren't also understandable and very familiar.
I've had malaria 5 times now. I have a bed net hanging above my bed. And I don't use it.
Why don't you do it?
It's 45 seconds. It's a burden. I don't want to. I either don't think about it or feel stubborn.
People everywhere, in rural Kenya, in New York, wherever, we just don't always do all the things we're supposed to do. The developed world has solved the water problem by essentially taking people out of the loop. We pipe clean water to everyone's homes. But it's going to be a long time before that happens here. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Kenya.
A few summers ago, food writer William Sitwell snapped up some cookbooks at a London auction, all from the 1800s. He was struck by how lively and opinionated their authors were,
making the kinds of claims you'd find in cookbooks today. Take the Royal Cookery Book, which boasted that it was the greatest compared to, quote, the perfect uselessness of such cookery books as have hitherto been published.
Pouring through those 19th century books transformed William Sitwell into something of a culinary Indiana Jones. And he dug further into the past, all the way back to ancient Egypt, through the most influential foodies from bygone times. The result? A History of Food in 100 Recipes, his new book celebrating the people and stories behind the cuisine that help shape the way we eat today. William Sitwell joined us from London. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with one of the first recipes, this from 350 BC. It was actually recorded in a poem. It's fish baked in fig leaves.
If people think that passionate food is something new, they need to look back where you come across a man called Archestratus, who was a sort of Sicilian traveling around Asia Minor, eating and getting hold of as much good food as he could possibly get, and then writing down his experiences. Now, he wrote them down in sort of ancient Greek hexameters, of which there are fragments left of these scrolls. And from one of those fragments, we've got this recipe, fish baked in fig leaves. And this man, I mean, he was wonderful because he was a real obsessive about the food that you should eat. He wrote, "Eat what I recommend. All other delicacies are a sign of abject poverty." He said, "If you can't get hold of sugar, demand some Attic honey," which is Greek honey, as that will set your cake off really well.
He also writes, "Otherwise one might as well be buried measureless fathoms underground."
It's the sort of thing you get from harsh food critics on TV shows who say, you know, "I'd rather die than have to eat this muck again." And an Archestratus would have been on MasterChef these days, you know, if he was around.
Let's stick with ancient times and ask you about one more food writer, Marcus Gavius Apicius.
Well, this is an extraordinary story. He wrote a book called De Re Coquinaria of Culinary Matters that came out in AD 10. And this book is still in print. I mean, it's just quite extraordinary. You can get a hold of translations today. And if anyone ever asks you, when was the Roman Empire at its strongest? Well, actually, the answer, I think, is when its sources were at its thickest. And its sources were at its thickest when Apicius was around. And this man was into sauce. I've had this recipe cooked. It's very decent. And what's amazing about Apicius was that, of course, he was very wealthy, but he met with a tragic end because he was such a great entertainer that he ran out of money. And he decided that if he couldn't live to the manner in which he'd become accustomed, that life then wasn't worth living. So he gave one final feast. We don't know quite what was at that feast, whether he served his pumpkin fritters or his lentils and chestnuts or his suckling pig stuffed two ways. But in the final course, the final dessert, I think it was, he poisoned himself and died from running stuff. And I know people who live to eat, and I can completely sympathize with his predicament.
You do write about the evolution of cooking throughout the book, but also techniques involved. Tell us about a breakthrough in how bread was made.
Well, a lot of people think that 1066 is an important date in English history, because it was the Battle of Hastings,
which was the Norman conquest of England.
That's right. But what people don't seem to focus on is that 1066 was also a very important moment for the history of bread, because after 1066, we see the introduction of the hair sieve. It suggests that people started to refine their bread. They started to sieve their flour so they could make really posh white loaves. And it was a real social symbol, whereas the beggars would eat the bone-crunching brown stuff. But of course, things have changed now. People sniff at white bread. But for many, many years, if you served white bread, it was like showing someone the latest iPhone. You know, it was a real fashion accessory.
Tell us the story behind hot chocolate, which is certainly one of the more dramatic ones in the book.
Well, one of the greatest meetings in history is between Montezuma, the Aztec king, and Hernan Cortes, the great Spanish conquistador. They met in 1519, just outside what is now Mexico City. And then you've got these two cultures, an incredibly ancient culture and a much more modern European culture coming face to face. When people say, is there a particular moment that actually is a turning point in the history of food? The Spanish conquistadors' conquest of the Aztecs is key because we get back amazing ingredients, not just gold, but coffee, tomatoes, turkeys, and of course we get chocolate. Montezuma, like many great leaders, didn't like to be seen eating, and he used to like to eat alone. But after he had eaten, he would then call for chocolate, and his servants would bring out to the great hall chocolate all frothed up. And it probably would have been quite a bitter thing in those days. It wouldn't have been the sort of sweet, luxurious thing that we know and love today. Cortes then brought that back to the Spanish court. The Spanish royalty thought it was the most extraordinary thing. They kept their recipe for making chocolate very much under wraps. And then people were also rather dismissive of chocolate. They thought it had rather bad qualities. Someone even said it was a bit addictive. Have you heard that before?
You know, you have, moving along in time, like, you have a recipe for salad dressing. It dates to 1699. That's very much on the long side. Something like 1,400 words for a salad dressing recipe.
What I love about this is that John Evelyn, he wasn't just noting down ideas for dressings for salads. He thought about it as a philosophical treatise. And I think this is one of the most beautifully written recipes in history. He talks about, you know, let your herby ingredients be exquisitely culled and cleansed of all worm-eaten, slimy, spotted, or in any way vitiated leaves. And I love that. It's much nicer than saying, isn't it? First wash your salad leaves. And then he talks about the oil. You know, the oil should be very clean, not too rich or too yellow, a pallid olive green and smooth, light and pleasant upon the tongue. Use vinegar, preferably infused with flowers such as nasturtium. He talks about salt must be the best, clean, bright and dry, and use a dash of honey or some sugar. I mean, it's fantastic. It's the most beautifully written recipe. And actually, it's spot on. And I think that's one of the great things about recipes in history, you know, the beauty, the almost poetic resonance that some of these recipes have.
Well, it has been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
William Sitwell's new book is A History of Food in 100 Recipes. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
I'm Steve Inskeep. Okay, let's just say it straight out. This is awesome. Next month, the original Star Wars movie will premiere dubbed into Navajo. This is the first time a major motion picture has been translated into a Native American language. Navajo families hope the project will help to promote and preserve their language. Here's Christine Trudeau of member station KUNM in Albuquerque.
When Dave Nezzi met his future wife, Amanda, they quickly fell in love over a galaxy far, far away.
I think that was one of the first things that bonded Dave and I together was our love for Star Wars, and our children have also caught the Star Wars bug.
The family lives in Albuquerque, and one of the biggest struggles they've come up against living off the reservation is teaching their kids Dave's native Navajo language.
Rosetta Stone has something. There's an app on the iPad, and having alternatives is what we need. Having more resources available will help us teach the language to more people.
Enter Star Wars.
There are definitely Star Wars nerds out there who can repeat that movie verbatim, and they speak no Navajo.
That's Manuelito Wheeler, director of the Navajo Nation Museum and the muscle behind the Star Wars translation project.
And so when they're watching this and it's in Navajo, it's them learning Navajo.
So he approached both the Navajo Nation and Lucasfilm, and the project went into hyperdrive.
This was an idea that I felt was a way to promote our culture, promote our language, a way to save our language.
But translating the film into Navajo was no easy feat. When dubbing a film into another language, syncing the translation with the character's lip movement is crucial to the pace of the film. Wheeler's wife, Jennifer, is a professor of English at the University of New Mexico in Gallup and is one of the translators working on the project. She gives this example of a translation problem. Think about how you'd say computer in Navajo.
You know, that's quite long.
Now imagine how you'd get across the concept of a droid. It's metal, it moves around, and it's a computer.
R2-D2 would be the short metal thing that's alive.
So the translation for droid? That won't be revealed until the premiere. In some ways, though, The syncing process might be somewhat easier for Star Wars because characters like Darth Vader deliver their lines behind a mask. Beyond the fun of translating phrases like Death Star, Jennifer Wheeler says the whole project demonstrates that the Navajo language is still alive.
This will be one historic event that will celebrate and recognize the fact that we're just part of society here in this Western society, in this country, but who we are as Navajo people living in this century, we really need to celebrate.
Do you want TV?
Do you want to watch Star Wars?
Yeah.
David, Amanda, Nezzy, and their kids are looking forward to sitting down to watch Star Wars in Navajo.
I want to hear what Millennium Falcon is in Navajo. I'm very curious. And our daughter, she'll be able to speak Navajo. She'll understand who she is. And what more of a beautiful way to do that than put it in Star Wars?
Absolutely.
The Nezzys are traveling to Window Rock, Arizona for the premiere, which is taking place as part of the Navajo Nation Fair. At this time, Lucasfilm has no plans for a wider theatrical release or DVD version of Star Wars in Navajo. For NPR News, I'm Christine Trudeau in Albuquerque.
NPR News, this is.
Today, the World Health Organization released the first global estimate of violence against women. The figures are high all over the world. And as NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports, the violence has serious implications for women's health in ways that aren't always apparent.
According to the new report, about one in three women aged 15 and above has been physically abused or raped. And over 85% of those women were attacked by their own partners.
I think this is a shockingly high figure.
Karen DeVries is at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and contributed to the WHO report. She's also the author of a paper on domestic violence in the latest issue of the journal Science. She says not only does domestic violence physically injure women, it can also lead to death.
38% of all women who were murdered were actually murdered by their intimate partners.
She says victims of domestic violence are also at a greater risk of developing a range of health problems, depression, alcoholism, and in some places even AIDS. And these health effects, DeVries says, may carry over into the next generation.
We see that women who've experienced partner violence have a greater chance of having a low birth weight baby.
The report is the first comprehensive look at levels of sexual and domestic abuse around the globe. Claudia Garcia Moreno is a physician with the World Health Organization and one of the lead authors of the report.
When we look at all this data together, what it flags is that this is a tremendous problem.
She admits that some of the findings may even underestimate the prevalence of violence against women. But, she says, the report goes well beyond just presenting data.
We are releasing guidelines for healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, midwives.
So they're better prepared to identify victims of domestic violence.
When and how to ask about domestic violence, how to respond appropriately to disclosure of violence.
There's a strong stigma attached to sexual violence, and most victims don't reveal that they were abused. But they do access regular healthcare facilities. So, Garcia Moreno says, doctors and nurses must be prepared to step in and help.
We want to see these issues integrated into the curriculum on the basic training of doctors and nurses.
The report is being well received by experts. Anita Raj directs the Center on Gender Equities and Global Public Health at the University of California, San Diego. She welcomes the report, especially the guidelines for health workers.
A lot of health providers don't have training on how to do assessments and screen to see if such violence has occurred.
And she says they often feel helpless when they do confront cases of sexual or domestic violence.
I think there's a lot of providers that worry, okay, now what am I going to do?
Raj says the new report is full of detailed advice and information about resources. Sohela Abdulali is with the Ubuntu Education Fund, a nonprofit that works on public health and sexual violence in South Africa. She agrees that the new report has the potential to make a big difference, but she says it could have gone further.
There's only one vague mention of social support.
Abdulali knows just how important social support is. She was raped herself as a teenager, and for years she worked with victims of sexual violence at a rape clinic in Boston.
Medical intervention is great, but really, if somebody comes into you for support, no matter what you give her, It can't make up for what she could get from her own communities.
She says most victims' families aren't supportive of them. In fact, they often blame the victim. Even one trustworthy person to talk to, Abdulali says, can take a victim a long way on the road to recovery. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station. This is NPR.
For millions of Americans, tuning into The Sopranos was a ritual, the kind of appointment TV that's getting rare. Tony Soprano's world on screen was filled with rituals, the way mobsters spoke, the invocation of religion, even the way Tony Soprano worked and worked his plate of pasta with a fork. This next story explores the power of rituals on our senses, starting with a ritual that comes just before we cut the cake.
Happy birthday to you.
Okay, and today we have a question. If you did not sing Happy Birthday or blow out the candles, would the cake taste any different? NPR social science correspondent Shankar Vedantam regularly joins us to share new social science research, and it turns out someone has been testing this very question. Hi, Shankar.
Hi, Steve.
Okay, did I hear your voice, by the way, in that Happy Birthday rendition just now?
You did, Steve. And I know your next question is going to be why I didn't pursue a career as a singer, and people have been asking me that all my life.
Sinatra Vedantam, indeed. Indeed. Okay, fine. But of course, you're a better reporter than a singer. What's the research about?
So anthropologists and writers and historians, Steve, have been exploring the idea of rituals for decades, but I was surprised to find there's actually very little quantitative research into the effect that rituals have on our lives.
And when you say rituals, you mean like the happy birthday song, the cake being carried out, the candles being lit and blown out, the whole deal.
Precisely. Right. I recently came by some interesting work by Francesca Gino at the Harvard Business School, and along with Kathleen Voss, Yajin Wong, and Michael Norton, they've just completed the first rigorous quantitative study on the effects that rituals have on eating.
Okay. What did they find?
So they ran a series of experiments, and one of them, they gave volunteers chocolate bars, and they asked some of the volunteers to perform a ritual. Now, without unwrapping the candy bar, they said, break the candy bar in half, then unwrap one half, eat the candy, unwrap the other half, and then eat the other half of the candy.
Okay, now you're going to tell me what the result is, but while you're doing that, I have this candy bar here. I'm going to work on that, okay? So go on, keep talking.
So they told the other volunteers to eat the candy bar exactly as they would like, and Francesca Gino told me there was a huge difference in the experience of people who had performed the ritual. Here she is.
When people engage in rituals, very simple rituals, we see that, in fact, what they tasted was more flavorful, they savored it for longer, and they would be willing to pay a higher price for what they just ate.
Wow, that's fascinating, Shankar. excuse me, let me swallow there. That's fascinating, but, you know, chocolate is good however you may eat it. I mean, most people would think so anyway. What about stuff that doesn't taste so good?
So they ran the same experiment with carrots, Steve, and they found the same thing happen. So across the board, rituals seem to increase anticipation and make people more mindful of what they were eating. Performing a ritual before you eat a carrot apparently makes the carrot more tasty than it was before. So the researchers then said, is it possible it's just performing some kind of physical activity before you eat that makes the difference? So they had people perform these random physical gestures, and they found that didn't make the difference. They also found that watching someone else perform a ritual did not have any effect. You had to do it. You had to follow a very specific script, and it was doing the ritual every single time that gave the ritual its power.
Okay, this is fascinating because, of course, we have rituals in all areas of life. People have morning habits. They have evening habits. There are habits of religion. We could go on and on, but let me ask about this. Can rituals go a little bit too far?
Yeah, you know, Francesca Gino told me that she has asked herself that same question, and recently her husband asked her a question about her own rituals. Here she is again.
My husband looked at me the other day as I was making my morning coffee, and once again, I put the milk that was at a certain level for 66 seconds in the microwave, and he asked me about it, and I said, this is my morning ritual, and I believe that is making me having a better time when I drink my coffee. And he looked at me and he said, why don't you describe it as OCD behavior?
So, Steve, when she says OCD behavior, of course, she's talking about obsessive compulsive disorder, and that's a very serious disabling disorder. And I guess the difference between a ritual and OCD is in the case of the disorder, you have the ritual taken to such an extent that it becomes disabling. So the question to ask really is the ritual helping you or is it hindering you? In sports, for example, rituals soothe us. They calm us down. And Francesca Gino and Michael Norton have another study which shows that after suffering a personal loss, performing a ritual helps you regain a sense of control. But, you know, the truth is there probably isn't much daylight between rituals and superstitions. It may be that we call our superstitions rituals and we call the rituals of other people superstition.
Okay, Shankar, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Shankar Vedantam regularly joins us to talk about interesting social science research. He's going to host a Google Hangout, by the way, a live video broadcast you can follow on your computer with Professor Francesca Gino today, noon Eastern Time. You can watch it at npr.org/ritual. Let me just finish this up. It's great. I'm glad I broke it in half. It's a ritual that at this moment each day we say. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
After years of focus in Washington, D.C. on improving science and math education in the country, now the humanities community is speaking out. Their message, "We Matter Too," came in the form of a report. That report was released yesterday by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and it's raising alarms about the state of education in humanities and social sciences. NPR's Corey Turner has the story.
First, what is humanities? Think the study of languages, literature, history, philosophy, and religion. And according to the report, the humanities, along with social sciences like economics and psychology, are being neglected in America. That's a problem, the report says, because the global economy requires skills that workers can only get studying the humanities. This isn't just about losing the arts. It's about losing money, power, and our place in the world.
The world has become interconnected. The more you know about other cultures, about other societies, the better you can function.
Pauline Yu is president of the American Council of Learned Societies and a commissioner behind the report. So is former ambassador Carl Eikenberry, who says our national security is at stake.
If you're going to make your nation more secure, you have to have a cadre in the business world, in academia, in the military, in the diplomatic corps that understands the world.
The report suggests, among other things, that we double down on the basics, reading, writing, and speaking, and encourage students to learn languages and study abroad. It was requested in 2010 by a bipartisan group of congressmen, including Democrat David Price of North Carolina. He says the humanities don't just help us understand the world, but who we are as Americans.
We need an appreciation of our history, of what binds us together as a country. There's a base of knowledge that's required for good, intelligent citizenship.
And the process, Price says, of teaching good citizens is in jeopardy. Corey Turner, NPR News.